Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Mags Morrissey.
Hello and you're very welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I am Frances Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages here in Kilkenny, and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. We're live today, Friday, and the show is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5. During the show today, we would love to hear from you, so please feel free to send us any questions or comments or just say hello. You can get in touch with the show by text to 086 353 7782 or you can call the station 776-2777 or email kitchengarden@ckc.ie, and you can email us at any stage during the week. Now, on the show today, we'll be talking the usual food news. Mags is going to be talking to us a little bit about school lunches. We'll remind you of some of the jobs to do in the garden around now. There's the usual nature notes, and we're off to Mount Juliet for a bit of trout fishing on the River Nore. Later in the and we'll also be talking to Dan O'Neill, the fishery manager from Mount Juliet. So, Mags, how was your week?
Very good. Very busy, but very good. So since I was here last week, I did a bread class on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Very enthusiastic, happy bakers, and they've been sending me pictures of their successes during the week, which is nice to get, actually.
That's great. And do you find the photographs stop coming after a little while?
And then randomly, months later, somebody will come with... Generally, it's a problem at that stage. Right. They've tried something and there's an issue, so they'll come back. So I did get one of those, actually, during the week, and I'm always happy to help.
So does follow-up after your classes as well. That's great.
I know, yeah. I should start charging for it really, shouldn't I?
That's not what we're about.
No, I suppose not. Spreading the bread love. Yep. But, and then, so that was at the weekend. Monday then, which was a lovely sunny day and stuff, was a gardening day in my house. So, and I had a small helper. My little niece was with me, who's mad keen into it. I'm not sure who's happier about that, her or me. But she spotted on one of the beech trees, which I hadn't seen before, was the buff-tip moth caterpillars. Loads of them, and they'd actually stripped a pile of the leaves on it. So I did bring you in one. I know you know what they look like, but I brought you in two actually.
So these are kind of hairy yellow and black caterpillars. They're very like the large white or the cabbage white butterfly caterpillars. They're stripy like those, but they're bigger and they're more hairy, aren't they?
And their heads are really black.
Yeah, really black kind of head.
But moth caterpillars tend to be quite striking actually. So but I don't know what these ones are doing at this time of the year. Because these moths fly kind of May to July. That's when you'll see them at night. So where these chaps are going. And on Monday, they were really active on the tree. They're all crawling around, a big kind of cluster of them on one branch. But I went out today to have a look, and they were really docile and all kind of clung into each other and clung to kind of one part of it. So unless they've sort of, and they're not looking very active here now.
No, they're cold. And
they are cold.
They're wet.
Yeah.
And they maybe realise that Mammy laid her eggs at possibly the wrong time of the year.
Yeah, and it is quite cool today, in fairness, compared to Monday, which was a lovely day. So, yeah, but they've stripped quite a bit now. They're not going to affect the tree and stuff, but if you had young trees, they could actually destroy it quite easily. You'll find them on birch, beech, a couple of other different types and stuff. I mean, they're all widespread, they're everywhere, but I just hadn't seen them like that before, actually. Quite.
You really only notice the moth caterpillar infestations on young trees because they eat an awful lot of leaf material. Like there's very little goodness in the leaves, so they eat an awful lot of leaf material. They can go through several a day themselves, and when you put 50 or 100 of them, which isn't uncommon, together, they will strip a small tree. So on a small tree, you'll notice the defoliation, you know, fairly quickly, whereas on a big tree, you might not.
Yes, exactly. Now, they have done a couple of branches, but this tree is maybe 20 years old, so it's not going to damage it irreparably, I don't think.
And a lot of them, like these ones here, so bright yellow and black, very, very noticeable. It's not like they're trying to blend in anywhere.
No, they're not going to blend into anything unless they like end up in a wasp nest, really.
But the funny thing is, the moth that comes from those is one of the best camouflaged moths. We'd often see that moth. It's quite a large moth. You'd often see it in the bathroom at night if you've left the window open and it comes in. It's the one that looks like the bark of a tree.
Like it looks like a birch branch.
Yes.
A little birch branch. But it's got a kind of a buffy head and then the buff tip at the bottom, the end of its wings and that. Quite spectacular looking, really, even though the colours are not spectacular, but the shape and everything is quite spectacular.
For years now, I've been meaning to set up a moth trap and capture some moths and have a look at them, because there's a friend of mine does it in Dublin and occasionally posts photographs. But like, he might get 20, 30, 40, 50 different moths in a night, depending on where he goes, you know.
Okay.
So we marvel at the butterflies, and they are gorgeous, and, you know, we see them floating around during the day and generally on calm summer days. So we associate the butterfly with those calm, sunny summer days. But at night, it's a much busier sky. There's an awful lot more moth species than there are butterfly species.
I would think you'll see them when you're driving home late at night and you can just see them in the lights, and that's kind of, but you're not really going to be identifying moths at that stage. You just want to go home.
But unfortunately, most of them have evolved to be to blend into their surroundings, because during the day they have to be invisible. They're not on the wing, they're resting during the day because they're nocturnal.
Yes.
So if they're against a branch or underneath a leaf, they have to kind of look like that. That's so awesome. They do look a bit, you know, kind of plain.
And they do, yeah. Colours, you don't see bright red or yellow.
No, it's like true,
that.
Like it's all browns and
which
greens.
Is funny that they're the caterpillars, but some of the moth caterpillars are quite striking, all sorts of unusual colours and that. Like the burnet moth, you know, that one, that's quite unusual, kind of red and black stripes.
I'm trying desperately now to remember the name of the moth that I got a great photograph of last year, and I put it up on Twitter. Much, much larger than those, now maybe six times their kind of width, so a really chunky one, the size of your small finger, very, very hairy, again a kind of yellow and black colour, but on the end a tuft of red hairs that grow to a point, so it actually looks like it has a sting. So the colours are kind of like, I'm probably poisonous, you don't want to eat me.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you come too close, Mr. Bird or Chicken, I have this sting here to give you a wallop with as well. It's only hair,
clever,
of course.
Isn't it?
Very clever.
Yes. The name evolution at its best.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh. So your tree, is it going to be okay?
Yeah, it'll be fine.
Did you give it a shake to knock the caterpillars off?
I did after, yeah. So, but they were really tightly stuck to each other today. So trying to survive, I'm guessing, I don't know.
Easier to knock the clump off, though, I'd imagine.
No, it would have been much easier the other day when they're all kind of wiggling around and kind of loose and stuff.
Right.
But today, even to get those two, I had to prise them off the others.
Right, okay.
Yeah,
I wonder, are they getting ready to pupate? Maybe they're trying to squeeze in the whole life cycle really, really quickly.
I don't know, I think they're probably a bit late.
Well, very striking things that they are.
Yeah.
It's not often that we look at these caterpillars and think, oh, wow, look at that. Normally it's, oh, no, there goes my cabbages.
What are they eating?
Kids are always fascinated by caterpillars, though. You know, seeing them crawling around, it's very unusual movement that they make. But I tried several times. I hear on Twitter and Facebook and stuff, people feeding the caterpillars to their chickens. My chickens have never eaten
because I remember giving the cabbage white caterpillars, well, I tried to get the hens to eat them because I had so many of them, they had no interest.
No.
I think they've built, their defences are that they don't get eaten by birds. So you don't ever see birds like hoovering them off cabbage or something.
Yeah.
So that's what they're made for. That's their survival.
And even if an individual species like the cabbage white or whatever isn't poisonous to the chicken, it probably looks like one that is, because they're all have that stripy.
But I don't think it's very palatable, that hair and stuff, you know. Yeah. So, I don't know what anything would prey on them.
Awesome. But the moths have plenty of predators. I remember poor Charlie raised a little caterpillar in the house one time, and the caterpillar died, but I replaced it with a moth. I thought I was doing a great job replacing a moth into the box where the caterpillar used to be.
Oh, good.
And the next day Charlie opened it, and there was Alan the moth in there, and he was delighted with himself. And he opened his window and he let Alan fly away, and Alan's flight lasted about a second and a half, and then a swallow ate Alan.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
Well, swallows need them, I suppose.
An early lesson for Charlie.
Yes, in
mortality.
Life.
Yes, yeah. Really.
The other exciting news out in Thomastown is the meadow saffron is in flower down at the meadow beside the river.
Beautiful.
Beautiful flower, actually. And I've been... It generally flowers end of August into September, maybe into early October. But we have a heritage walk on Sunday, so we're hoping it was going to be flowering in time for that. So I went out this morning and lo and behold, there it was. So because the leaves have died back before the flowers come. So like 10 days ago, the last time I was down there, there was nothing to see. So you're kind of like just hoping and praying. But a beautiful little flower. Looks like a crocus. It's not a crocus, but it does look, it has a, you know, a kind of a...
goblet-shaped flower.
Goblet shape, exactly. On quite a white, delicate stem. And it kind of forms in carpets, little carpets and stuff. So there's nice little clusters in that field. It's an endangered plant in this country. They reckon that it was brought in by the kind of in early Christian times by the monks and stuff, so probably came with Durpoint Abbey or around that time. And there's speculation, sometimes it's kind of, it's not confirmed, but that it was used maybe in the dyeing process, the stamens might have been used in the dyeing process, or also there's also speculation that it was used in some part of the brewing process. Now, that doesn't really work if it's poisonous, but...
It's deadly poisonous. Every part of the plant is poisonous. So unless there was something extracted from it that the brewers were able to use or some fixing agent...
Yeah, I don't know about that, but there is speculation that it was. But you'll find it in Kilkenny, so along the Nore, and one other site in Ireland.
That's incredible.
It is incredible, isn't it? So it's found in one of the tributaries of the Shannon in Limerick.
Wow.
So this site is of national importance. And it's not managed by Parks and Wildlife or anything like that. So it's kind of...
Left to its own device.
It is a little bit. There would have been hay or silage or something cut from this field earlier in the year. There's nothing on it at the moment, and cattle won't eat it. But of course they would stand on it.
Yeah,
like they're
yeah,
not,
yeah.
you know. But if the cattle stay off it for another while, then the cattle are important. So grazing is important after the flowers have died back to spread the seeds and to spread it. So, but it's quite a, it was kind of a damp morning and stuff, but it's quite beautiful looking because it's a delicate little kind of purpley flower and stuff. But when you see a little carpet of it, it is quite spectacular, and it'll keep coming. There's probably lots more in the next couple of weeks down there.
So, I love it because I'm really, really fond of crocuses, because in the spring they're one of the earliest flowers to come through, and it's a sign of things to come. You know, it kind of gladdens the heart.
Yeah.
And then as the season starts to turn, so now it's feeling a bit more autumny, although we might have nice weather coming next weekend, but at the moment it's a bit kind of chilly.
It is.
And then you go out and you see the meadow saffron, and again you're reminded of the crocus, and
It's a bit of cheer, actually.
It is a bit of cheer. Yeah. Lovely
when
flower.
I was down there this morning, there was two buzzards screeching overhead. I'm not sure what was going on with them, but it's all go.
We've spoken about the buzzard on the show a few times before, but I was talking to a guest at the cottages during the week and saying how about 8 years ago when the buzzards first start nesting at Crowan, I was so excited. And for a couple of years thereafter, when I heard them doing that really high-pitched whistle in the sky overhead, I'd look up every time, and it was just amazing. 8 years on, it's non-stop. Yeah. There's just buzzards all the time. It's a great success story for like a raptor to be doing so well. But the kind of novelty is worn off a little bit.
It's still kind of nice though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I assume though there's going to be some effect from the huge increase in numbers. It has to happen, really. So something is going to have to give somewhere.
Well, they're predating on something.
Is it
rabbits or
like
squirrels?
There would have been none here 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And now, like, a day doesn't go by that you don't see them. I see them on gateposts and electricity wires and, you know. So, anyway, we'll see what happens.
Their call is incredible. But that sounds like it was a lovely walk. So you had a misty, damp morning, the crocuses coming through, and two buzzards overhead.
Two buzzards and a heron. And what else? Yeah, there's some nice... It's a nice walk, actually, up to the viaduct. So
so you're doing that on Sunday as part of Heritage Week?
Yeah, Sunday morning.
And people can just show up? Where
show
are you meeting?
11 o'clock at the Ollie Walsh statue. Bring good footwear, a pair of wellies, really, if it's damp. And we'll walk up along the river. Going to talk about the mill, so the industrial archaeology or industrial heritage, and then some natural heritage along the way too.
Well, I was on your walk last year up in the other direction down past the castle there, Thomastown, and it was really, really interesting and a great mix of nature and archaeology, and it was fabulous. So I'd say this weekend's walk would be just as good. So 11 o'clock at the Ollie Walsh statue in Thomastown. There's parking there.
Plenty of parking.
Plenty
there.
Of parking.
Yeah, not suitable for buggies.
Well worth doing.
Yeah, it's really nice that it's Heritage Week is happening now when the meadow saffron is in flower.
And that's superb.
We're so lucky to have something special here.
Just make sure your crowds of walkers now don't tramp all over the
meadow
saffron.
Oh, don't worry, we have crowd control plans.
Okay, you're bringing along those kind of electric poking sticks that they use for cattle. Now, we're going to have to take an ad break shortly, but before we kind of move on, we haven't touched on food yet at all, but there is one food news story that caught my eye during the week. Have you heard about this kind of robotics in food service? So at the moment, I don't frequent fast food restaurants all that much. But a friend of mine tells me you go into a McDonald's now and you make the order on a kind of tablet.
You can do, yes.
You never speak to a human. And then somebody calls a number or something flashes up like in another shop and you go up and you collect your bag and that's it. So you never speak to a human. Well, a chain of burger bars in America called Cali Burger, they've taken that a step further now, where you can put in as complex an order for your burger as you like from all of these options on a kind of tablet computer, and then a robot actually fabricates your burger based on your preferences. So the mix is made in the machine, it's flopped onto a hot plate, the robot does the turning, cooks the burger, another robot is dressing up the bun, just like you'd see in a car manufacturing plant. The robots make your burger and they're delivered in a box at the end for you to collect.
Wow.
I presume there's some humans there to kind of load up the hoppers of food, but you never deal with a human from start to finish. I read this and it was kind of being celebrated as the future of like fast food service and convenience and so on. To me, it just sounds horribly depressing.
It is a bit depressing. Can I tell you a very quick story, though?
You can.
One of my children won a 10 euro voucher from McDonald's about 3 or 4 years ago at something. So it had to be spent. I'd never been to McDonald's with them before. So we arrived into McDonald's in Kilkenny, and there was one of those machines where you can put in your order and stuff. So it took us a long time because nobody knew what. Anyway, put it all in and stuff, and then went to pay. But those machines don't take vouchers.
Oh.
So then you have to go up and talk to
go find a human.
Yeah, exactly.
I see. So there's a breakdown in the system already. But the one thing, as I was reading the story, I just remember reading at one point that somebody said, one philosopher said that the one thing that separates us from the animals apart is that we can eat facing each other without any fear of the other person stealing our food. Animals, dogs, when you think about dogs, they kind of turn their back on each other. They'll take their food away to a private place, particularly if it's a good one. A chicken will grab a crust and run off with it.
That's true.
There's no notion of sharing, whereas humans can sit opposite each other and communicate or just be in each other's company as we eat.
Yeah.
It's what sets us apart, and now we're getting to the stage where we're removing that social aspect of eating. Anyway, on that cheery note, we better take an ad break and we'll be back shortly just after these. Text us on 086 353 7782. You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. And welcome back to The Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages, and I'm here with Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. And we're live today, Friday, from 4 to 5, and the show is repeated on Monday at the same time from 4 to 5. And you can send us in any comments or questions that you might have to 086-353-7782 or email the show kitchengarden@corkc.ie. Now, Mags, you wanted to talk to us about school lunches.
Well, yes, as my firstborn went back to school today, and it's kind of the topical thing at the moment. And I was kind of thinking about primary and secondary school. In primary school, they want to eat their lunch as fast as possible so they can go out and play like 40-40 or chasing or whatever. In secondary school, their socialising is a little bit over their lunch because they sit down together and they'll chat and stuff. So you need completely different lunches almost for those two things. Because I find with the small guys, they just want things that they can either like eat as they're running out the door or things that are fast to eat. So the firstborn went off this morning with, it was pasta left over from yesterday, just plain pasta with cucumbers and hazelnuts, a little bowl of that, and she'd have eaten that.
My God.
And that's perfectly balanced if you think about it.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of everything
carbs
in that. Yeah. And I think cold pasta is a great thing because it kind of bulks them up and stuff, but that's not really suitable for primary school kids. They don't have the time for it and they don't have the concentration really. So for secondary school, that works really well. So like cold pasta, couscous, and you can add in whatever you want, like grated carrot or sweet corn or cucumbers or tomatoes if they'll eat them, or red onion. I put runner beans into my couscous the other night and they did eat them, not relish them, but they did eat them. And they're really handy things to have because you can have it kind of half ready from the night before. And of course, children should make their own lunches, I think, really. And once they're over like about 7, or even younger if they're able for it. Another thing that is handy actually is a little tub of peanut butter and some like an apple or a sliced apple in another tub and stuff, and just dip and eat. They'll eat that. or hummus and like breadsticks, or hummus and fruit as well. You know, you can mix and match things, whatever they'll eat really. There's a carrot salad we make at home that they'd often take for school, which is just grated carrot, sweet corn and seeds or pine nuts or whatever you want to add into that. Just toast the nuts a little bit and add it all in together. And that's perfectly healthy, and you could even mix that with your pasta and you've got something that's quite nutritious. Now, they don't get treats. There's no treats Monday to Friday in school lunches, and I don't believe any school needs to have treats at any stage, to be honest. And I don't think they should be given out for things and stuff, because I think kids get so many treats now that we shouldn't even be calling them treats anymore, because it's non-stop. And there's no Nutella sandwiches or chocolate rice cakes or any of that kind of stuff. And my kids get plenty of treats. I sound like I'm on a soapbox now. But I do think, you know, in general, the whole country is a bit overweight. And kids between, you know, in the hours of school and stuff, there's great excuse not to give them anything, because you can say it's not allowed in school. So don't give it to them. They don't need it.
I completely agree with you on that. But a lot of the dishes that you're describing there that the kids take away to school as lunch, none of those would have been considered kind of traditional lunches. So in the day, there would have been the sandwich. And you brought off the sandwich and maybe a flask or maybe a bottle or a drink or whatever.
Perfectly fine. Absolutely. And for the primary school kids, a sandwich is a good thing, actually. I would make kind of rolls, like a big batch of them, pop them in the freezer. Boys would take them out in the morning and they'll make their own sandwich. And it would often be, you know, kind of a cold meat thing, plenty of ham sometimes, or some roast chicken from Sunday, Monday and Tuesday. They like kind of cold beef or cold lamb and stuff. I don't eat cheese in sandwiches, you know. And kids have all these little fussy bits and pieces, and you have to work with that because you want them to eat something healthy. Mine will take slices of cucumber, they'll take slices of pepper. And now they're not perfect children, like food-wise in any shape or form, but there's no biscuits, there's nothing else. So they'll eat it, they'll take it and they'll eat it. And lunch is very rarely come back.
But does the primary school out in Thomastown do the Food Dudes program?
Yeah.
Okay, so the Food Dudes program in primary schools is where every day the kids are introduced to a new fruit or vegetable, and they get a tick box if they go through every day having sampled them.
Taste things more than once, because it does take a bit of time to develop a liking.
And they have to bring in kind of healthy fruit and veg lunches for that week. And then at the end of the week, they get rewards, pencils and stickers and a nicely divided box, lunchbox that lets you bring in small amounts of food or fruit or veg. What I found from that program was that mine were always taking in kind of like healthy sandwiches or whatever, but then they really got into a chopped up carrot or some sugar snap peas or something from the garden that I never would have thought of giving them, but they got used to eating chunks of fruit or veg during the day in school.
Yeah, I think it's been a successful program. It has actually. Mine would have done it last year. But they do that now anyway. But they're really handy things to eat, and they can eat them really quickly with their fingers and stuff. And also they kind of, you know, kids like to pick at things, so they have that feel about it. I know some schools have banned nuts because somebody is allergic. I know in Thomastown there's no nuts allowed, but dried fruit is another really handy thing if your kids will eat that. And there's a huge variety of dried fruits that you can buy. Peanut butter sandwiches, perfectly good if kids don't like meat or something, or almond butter if you want, you know, something that has a different bit of flavour and stuff. Now I suppose they're nuts, so you can't bring them into some schools. Fruit, of course. But not all fruit kind of stays good in a box if it's been rattled around in a bag. So I find, like, you know, blueberries are good. Strawberries don't tend to last like that. But whatever's in season and stuff.
Apples and bananas are perfect.
Like, you can't go wrong with them.
Fantastic kind of ready-packed food that you can bring away.
And really fast to eat.
Very fast.
When you went to race out in the yard.
Very nutritious.
And I think teachers have enough to do without kind of policing lunchboxes. That's not what they're there for. They're there to teach them and stuff. I think it's parents' responsibility to police the lunchboxes.
Absolutely. Well, they told us early on out in Dunamagan in the primary school that they wouldn't police them. So if you gave the kids lunch, like they told you, they encouraged you to give them a healthy lunch. They gave you guidelines on it. But thereafter, it was up to yourself. Now, I'd imagine if I was a teacher, I would throw my eye over the lunchboxes every now and again, because if some kid is coming in with half a packet of chocolate biscuits, they're going to be bouncing off the walls in the afternoon. So for their own sanity, they probably do throw an eye over them. And sadly, you do hear the stories. Like, the kids are great at coming home with horror stories about other kids' lunchboxes. You know, little Timmy came in today and all he had was you know, 3-star bars or
yeah, and it's kind of sad actually.
Yeah,
you know, it is sad.
Everybody gets caught out, and if you're just coming back from a trip and you don't have bread or whatever in the house, or you might get stuck and you have to make do some morning. But it is amazing how many kids, you know, don't do the Food Dudes program because they don't eat veg and they don't eat fruit and they don't, you know, it's kind of sad.
I think when they get to secondary school, it's a little different because particularly girls and stuff, they're very kind of carb conscious and weight conscious and everything. So you have to kind of introduce more, you know, so that's why like salad-y type things seem to go down quite well.
Now, there's a text in here from another Margaret, actually, and she's saying, we don't all have time in the morning to make nutritious lunch for the kids to go off to school, but it doesn't really take a huge amount of time.
So if you made pasta for dinner on Tuesday evening, that can be brought into school on Wednesday or on Thursday.
Margaret had nutritious in inverted commas there as well. I think she's a bit angry with our message, full stop. But kids can, like mine are 10 and 11 and they make their own lunches in the morning. So you give them the kind of guidelines and then away you go. Make a sandwich with whatever you want in it, so long as it has, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Ingredient A, B,
doesn't have
or
a biscuit.
C.
Yeah.
Martha makes cold pasta or cold noodles, which I think is just incredibly.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, you can make a nice noodle salad, actually, in fairness. Yeah, with peppers and scallions and that. And that's quite an easy thing to do. And you know what? A lot of our kids have plenty of time. So in the evening, they could get that ready.
Yeah, and stick it in the fridge, and then the following morning they take it away. Yeah. So, Margaret, there are options. It doesn't all have to be done in the morning before you head out to school. And I know everybody is busy in the morning heading off to work and stuff like that.
And it's important.
The night before.
I think,
and it is important.
It is important.
Because I think, like, we develop, humans operate by habit. So we perform the same, or we do the same things over and over again because we've gotten into the habit of doing them. So if you eat a large bag of crisps and drink a full bottle of wine every night, that becomes a habit.
Yes.
And it's going to be hard to stop doing that. Mm. Whereas if you eat a nutritious lunch every day that has some fruit in it, doesn't have a massive amount of empty calories, it doesn't have a whole pile of chocolate and sweet stuff in it, you're developing a habit that you'll have maybe for the rest of your life where you'll always have a decent lunch, you know.
Also, if kids kind of have the responsibility of making their own lunch, they're choosing what they want. Once they're choosing healthy things, and then they will generally eat it more than if they've been shoveled whatever, something that they don't want. If they don't like cucumbers, give them peppers. You know, you don't have to make them eat anything they don't like. I don't think that's fair. But I have one boy and he peels a full carrot in the morning and pops it straight into his lunchbox as a whole carrot. And that's what he'll eat.
Well, that's a fantastic food stuff. Like, you know, a carrot, you can't go wrong with
and
that.
And everyone has carrots. Like, they do, you know, there are always some carrots around.
A bag of them is for nothing. Like, 39 cents I see them now in the German retailers, like,
yeah,
for a bag
another
of carrots.
Yeah, that's another day's conversation,
really,
isn't it, really?
So you can't really go wrong with that kind of thing.
No.
A little bread roll. What I have noticed, though, is some people left behind unopened bags of lunch rolls in the cottages recently. And Martha was helping me clear out the cottages and brought back over these kind of brioche-style buns. And when we opened them, my God, they were so sweet. Mm. There was so much sugar.
Did you see like
in the bun?
Did you look at the ingredients in those?
I actually did. I had a look at the back, and the bun had the equivalent, I think it was about 300 calories were just in a bun. Like, that's an awful lot of sugar in just a bread bun.
And you don't need sugar in bread at all, ever. I'm always telling people that at classes. People think you don't.
But this was a packet. This was clearly marketed at kids, clearly aimed at the kind of lunch trade. So it was like kids with school bags and, you know, eating their lunch, cartoons on the bag. So these bread buns were aimed at mammy to help you get ready in the morning for your school lunch. But just like with their school breakfasts, the lunches, you really have to look at what's in them.
You do, yeah. I suppose, and with a bag of pasta, you kind of know what's in it. There's not really hidden things, so there we go. But you do, but bread is, we might have another bread conversation another day.
Yeah, but buyer beware. But the message of our school lunch story is that there's great variety. It doesn't have to be 2 slices of bread with a piece of hang in the middle.
No.
You know, you can make your little salads, bring along your carrots, bring along some chopped vegetables and a little dip of hummus or something like that to go with it, or salads. And all of the lunchboxes now tend to come kind of compartmentalised,
yes,
so
yeah.
it doesn't all get mixed together.
Yeah, and the kids can do it themselves as well.
Get the kids in doing it themselves. Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Now, we might put some of those recipes and ideas up on the with the podcast this week when we're doing that. And all of the podcasts of the show and the recipes that we talk about every week are available on thekitchengarden.ie. Now, we'll be taking an ad break shortly, and then you have to rush off, and I'm going to be talking about the garden and heading off to do a bit of fishing in Mount Juliet. But before we go, you were at the Totally Terrific Tomato Festival last week in the Botanic Gardens.
Yeah, I hadn't been in the Botanic Gardens for a couple of years. It's
lovely. You sound so surprised that I'm mentioning this. Do you not read your running order, Margaret?
Sorry? I'm too busy for that sort of crack.
So you were in the Botanic Gardens.
I was, yes, and I'm sure I met you. Yeah, really nice. Botanic Gardens are beautiful anyway, and such a peaceful place, you know, and it's free. And you can just wander around. The glass houses are just spectacular.
It's stunning.
It really is, for everybody. Like, kids and everything are kind of, like, entertained because it's so lovely, and there's kind of nice areas just for to watch, and there's lovely, some of the plants and stuff. We were in the, you know, the tropical greenhouse and stuff, and it was really interesting and kind of exciting, actually.
I used to live directly across the road from it on Botanic Avenue, and I used to be over to the Botanic Gardens the whole time, and it had been at least a dozen years since I was in the gardens, and I saw huge changes. So I was there a little after you, around lunchtime, so maybe it was a bit busier when I was there, but it was packed.
Oh, okay.
Busloads of people were arriving, and the canteen or the cafeteria or the restaurant or whatever that was there was really busy, very hard to get at a table. But a lot more buildings and kind of interpretation centres and conference rooms and education rooms. The restaurants, they weren't there a few years ago. The greenhouses are in incredible shape.
Yeah.
And the planting was so colourful.
Yes.
Really beautiful planting.
Yeah. Like, you could lose yourself for 2 or 3 hours wandering, couldn't you?
I think we have to go and do an OB or something from there. I was
talking, the tomatoes were terrific as well.
They were really great. Yeah, and they've set a European record. They had 241 tomato varieties at the latest count that I saw, and that's the biggest collection of tomatoes that have ever been in one place at the same time in Europe.
Wow.
So they're hoping to break a world record next year by hitting over the 300 mark. But isn't that incredible? In Ireland?
Yeah.
Not Italy.
Not a tomato growing country, really. Yeah.
241 varieties in Ireland in the same place.
Great colours and shapes and sizes, and
they were amazing things to look at. Amazing things.
And really nicely set out, actually. I had been to the one in Kilruddery a couple of years ago, which was lovely as well, but this was spectacular.
Now, well done to Nicky Kyle and Jane Paris, and of course to Matthew Jebb, who we talked about, the director of the Botanic Gardens. We talked to him a couple of weeks ago. Well done to them all. Now, we better take another ad break, and coming up after the ads this time, we're off to Mount Juliet for a spot of fly fishing. And Mags, you're going to leave us now.
I'll be back. Listening to you.
And you'll be back next week. So we'll head off to Mount Juliet just after these ads. Text us on 086 353 7782.
Hello, I am John Flynn. It's a regrettable truth that the better the quality of the soil, the bigger and more prolific the weeds. Don't we all know that?
And you're welcome back to The Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt. Mags has just popped off, so I'm here on my own now, live from 4 to 5. And you can get in touch with me at this stage. It's probably easiest by text, 086-353-7782. Or, of course, you can email the show at any stage, kitchengarden@ckc.ie. And Glenda has been in touch by text message, and she says that you don't have to make the good lunches in the morning. You can make them the night before. And Glenda, you're absolutely right, and we hope that some people take that message away from today's show, and they do that. It's most important that the kids have a healthy and nutritious lunch to help them concentrate on what they're doing and get through the day. When you make it, well, that do whatever suits you best. Now, in Kilkenny, we are blessed to have Mount Juliet House, stunning building, and the estate, very large estate. And as part of the estate, offers private fishing on 2.5 miles of the middle to lower reaches of the River Nore, just a short stroll from the manor house. Now, for many years, the estate has been regarded as one of the finest fishing houses in Ireland. And of course, it is open to the public to go and do some fishing along the river. You have to pay a fee, or you can become a member out at the estate and do some fishing that way. But I brought a group of French anglers along recently for a day's trout fishing in on the River Nore. And this is how we got on. I'm here today with my friend Tanguy de Toile from Durrow and County Laois, who owns the Durrow Country School, and who we've spoken to before on the show about his beekeeping techniques and also his gardening classes. But as well as being a gardener, Tanguy is also a fly fishing tutor and guide, and for the past 20 years has been bringing a group of French anglers to Ireland. They've since become friends of his, and for the last 2 or 3 years I've been able to bring the lads to Mount Juliet to enjoy some of the fly fishing here on the estate. Today we're going to park up at the main house and wander down to the river and try our hands at some fly fishing for some of the River Nore's trout. The stretch of the River Nore that runs below Mount Juliet House and through the estate is probably one of the most picturesque areas in Kilkenny. Just a few minutes out from Kilkenny City, but a world apart from the streets and bustle and lots of tourists as they wander through the medieval town. This is that type of landscape made famous by Capability Brown. A managed landscape set out with idyllic copses of trees, grassland. There are some horses enjoying the grass on the other side of the river. Beautiful gardens behind me, and as I look up towards the house, it stands so majestically above us, overlooking the river and the estate.
I'm Tanguy de Toulgouette. I have brought some friends with me. We are going to fish in Thomaston, a very good fishing stretch in Mount Juliet, and it is very low, with very little water. The hatches are not so good during the day, not so good in the evening. The best time would be certainly around 9 o'clock, even 5, if you could wake up quite early, 5 to 9 I would say. And we are going to fish with spent. The spent, they are dead flies. When you have a hatch in the evening, some of the flies will die, and the fish will take them very well in the morning, early morning. I can hear the fall now, the water. There are some stretches shaded, and that would be the best location, the shade, to fish, because the fish usually do not like the sun.
Un gobage. Deux gobages. Trois. Ils sont discrets, oui. Mais ça gobe quand même un peu.
There's four anglers with us today. Who are the lads and where are they from?
So they come from the Champagne area. They are coming with me since 20 years. I used to be fly fishing guide. And since then, every year they are coming to fish with me for a week.
And they like the fishing here in Ireland?
They love the fishing. We fish the Three Sisters, and they fish as well in Navan for Cavan for pike during the winter. So they love Ireland, yeah.
And are they as good as you now? Are they going to leave any trout for me?
It's catch and release policy.
Good man, Tanguy.
Mais tu sais sur quoi? Tiens.
Tu es petite?
Oui, un cul de canard.
Oui.
Un
cul de canard. Ok. Ah, pour moi? Yeah. Merci, merci. Il s'appelle Alan.
Oh, non, non. It's a mixed tubs, CDC, and parachute.
Parachute.
Okay. It's Alan Tops in this country. It's mine tops. But you unhook a lot. It's a small hook.
Yeah. Now, but you have to catch them before you can even pull the hook out, so. You can feel the excitement build as we approach the river, and the anglers see the first dimples on the surface of the water as the trout rise to take some flies. Just in front of us I see four rises on a very shallow stretch, the beautiful River Nore.
just above the White Bridge on the Mount Juliet Estate. It's fabulous that we have such places to bring visiting anglers. And the fact that our fishing in Ireland is relatively inexpensive. The lads are telling me that in France a day's fishing on a stretch of water like this would cost hundreds of euro if you were able to get access. As we got set up by the river, I spoke to Alan, one of Tongi's friends and a regular visitor to Ireland.
I used to come there from more than 25 years now. I enjoy the place. It's a very nice place for fly fishing. The river Nore is beautiful. Sometimes the fishing is incredible. Sometimes it's hard. Yeah. That's a fishing rule.
Today I think will be hard because the water levels are quite low, the sun is very, very high, and it's very, very warm.
Yes, it's very difficult today because it's too much sunny. But we have to do with that. It's a rule of fly fishing.
And it's a nice day to be out.
Oh, yes, it's a very nice day. I think that we can expect some nice trout today. Not so much, but some nice trout.
Excellent. Well, best of luck, Alan. Okay, here's a good spot. There's a wall opposite and some overhanging trees. There's a gentle ripple on the water, which will help hide the line. I can see some yellow flies hatching. And just in front of me, in the shadow of one of those giant lime trees, I've seen a trout come to the surface to take a fly, so we'll have a go here.
I felt that one. I actually felt that one on.
So mixed results here in Mount Juliet today, with some fish, lots of fish being caught by Tongi, as usual. Most of the French visitors had one or two fish. Alan did very well with three. And of course, me being the guide and showing them around, making all the effort, I rose one fish but didn't manage to land it. Still, it was a beautiful, beautiful day on the river here in the Mount Juliet Estate. And one of the fantastic advantages of fishing somewhere like this is that now it's just a short walk from the river up to the clubhouse, where we can all have a delicious lunch.
Hello.
Déjeuner? On y va.
And that really was a beautiful day out at Mount Juliet. And yep, there is a text message in. Is that the Trout Quintet? And it was. Well spotted. That was the Trout Quintet playing the background of that report from Mount Juliet. Now, I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Dan O'Neill, who is the fishery manager out at Mount Juliet. How are you, Dan?
Not too bad. And yourself?
Having a great day, thanks. And lovely memories there of my wading in the River Nore on a sunny day during this summer. Not a bad spot for you to be working, Dan.
No, it's a fabulous spot in a way. I'm very, very lucky to be down there, I suppose, you know. And sometimes it's hard to beat the temptation of going down to fish rather than doing a bit of work, we'll say, down there, you know.
Now, primarily the fishery is made up of about 3 kilometres or 2.5 miles or thereabouts of the river, and then there's three ponds out there. But these are facilities of the hotel or the estate, aren't they?
Yeah, so the three lakes that are there are, there's one that's 1 acre, then there's a 2 acre lake and a 3 acre lake, and they were stocked with carp some years ago, and during floods and stuff over the years, dace and roach have come in from the Nore into it, and they're used for people that are staying in the hotel if they want to try coarse fishing rather than game fishing. Mm-hmm. A lot of, like, it's fly water on the River Nore, so. Mm-hmm. Some people, they just are afraid of fly fishing, I suppose, in a way, and they just want to try a bit of coarse fishing. It's a different step for them, you know.
Yeah, so it's a kind of a countryside pursuit, but a little bit easier than fly fishing, which like can take years to perfect. I've been doing it for years and years and years now, and I still consider myself a novice.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the same myself. I mean, you will learn every single day. You will learn. I've often been down fishing and I've looked at the flies around the water that have hatched, and you would have an exact replica of that fly. And it doesn't matter how many times you let it down the river, the trout won't take it. But then you might notice two or three different flies that there's only a scarcity of, and they could be taking them. And it's something that you learn every day.
Yeah,
you learn every day with fly fishing.
It really is a learning experience, and the fish control it. So you can do a perfect cast of a fly that you think is absolutely perfect for that time of the year, and if the trout aren't feeding or if they're not eating that particular fly, they will just ignore you.
You're exactly right. And it was only three evenings ago I was down fishing, and I have never seen as many trout in my life rising in front of us, and we had the right flies and we were just letting it past them, and they had absolutely no interest. They could rise a split second before it or a split second after it, but they would never take the one that the hook was in, whether they can see the line, which I'm sure they can, or it's just something is not right. Everything has to be right.
So you have to match the natural stuff that they're eating, and then your presentation has to be perfect. And they spook so easily as well. So if they see any of the line, or they see you, or they hear you banging about, very unlikely you're going to get them.
Exactly, and with the current conditions and the water levels being so low, at the moment they're actually at 0.16 in Mount Juliet, whereas last year the lowest we had was 0.28. So with the water being so low, and you're casting your shadow kind of travels a little bit further as well, it's really easy to spook the fish. And I've had to go down to line that's a very thin diameter and a fluorocarbon, so it's 2.6 pounds breaking strain, which is incredibly light, and you have to be very careful with it too. And the fish will see anything heavier than that, and you can actually see the fish spook from it. They will turn away from it, and they'll leave the pool, they'll leave the general area, you know.
There's a story I often tell about one of the nicest casts I ever cast with a fly rod in my life was in Mount Juliet. I was wading in the river down there one time. I saw a trout rise underneath a tree, and I wondered, would I be able to get the fly in under the branches of the tree? And it was around May time. I put on this massive big mayfly, and it landed so delicately under the tree branches on the water in the exact spot I wanted it. And I was so delighted with myself that I completely missed the take of the fish that went for the fly. So even when you get it right, you can still get it wrong.
Yeah, and you look, and when you make a cast like that, you just wish that there was someone there to actually see that cast.
Or videotape it.
Or video this cast, and while you're thinking all that in your head, the fish has jumped, tried to sweep the fly, and you've missed it. Yeah.
Exactly.
I know the feeling.
So you're taking people down from the hotel to do a little bit of fishing. There's the club there as well, of which I'm a member, and we do some fishing along the river there as well. Can members of the public just buy a day ticket to fish on the river?
Yes, on the river they can, yeah. They can have what's called an evening trout fishing, so they can come down there at whatever, 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening and stay for the evening rise and fish for trout. If it was salmon, obviously you'd have to have a salmon license and then pay for your ticket in as well, we'll say, just to fish the pools. We provide salmon licenses down there, or day salmon licenses if you like either, you know.
Yeah, and how much is an evening's fishing if somebody wanted to go in and do something?
An evening's trout fishing is 40 euros.
40 euro. Well, I have to tell you, Dan, that it's an absolutely fabulous spot, and for 40 euro, it's an amazing value if you're into your fishing at all, because the setting is stunning, and you're fishing one of the best rivers in Ireland. There's a huge population of native brown trout there, and anglers that I've brought down from the UK or from France will tell me that you would pay hundreds for a day's fishing or an evening's fishing on a river like it in those countries. So it's an amazing resource we have in Kilkenny.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. And there's minding on it, but I mean, like a man told me one time, if you like the job you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And that's the way I see it, you know. And I'm going up and down there, and it was a childhood dream, really, to be able to have such a stretch of water and trying to look after it and being out in nature and being paid to do it, I suppose, is a dream, you know.
Well, fair play to you, Dan. And what I'm going to do is, after the show, I'm going to text you my number, and if ever you feel like retiring, I want you to give me a shout and give me advance notice so I can apply for your job.
No problem. It might come sooner than you think. You never know.
Thanks a million. And that was Dan O'Neill, the fishery manager out in the beautiful Mount Juliet Estate here in County Kilkenny, and a stunning place to go for a walk or for a cup of tea in one of the various kind of restaurants or bars that they have out there. Now, leaving our leisurely pursuits on the river behind, it's time to head into the garden and have a chat about some of the jobs which need doing this week. And I know that a lot of people have started to harvest their spuds, but there are some of the main crop spud varieties would still appreciate a bit more time in the ground. And the conditions, although they've gotten a bit cooler, there's some warm weather on the way, and it may be there may be a blight warning announced. So if you do, if you are planning on keeping your spuds in the ground for another bit and they're still green and you want to avoid blight, you may want to do some spraying later in the week. If you are harvesting your main crop of potatoes, generally leave it until the leaves and the stalks are yellowing and starting to die back, and then you've reached peak growth in your spuds at that point. If the leaves aren't green anymore, they're not taking in any goodness, and they're not going to grow the swell the tubers in the ground anymore. So it's time to start taking them out. Try storing the potatoes in hessian sacks if you can get them, or I use the paper feed sacks that the chicken food or the animal food comes in. They're double layers of very thick paper, so it keeps the spuds nice and dark so they don't go green. I put them into those and then put them in a cool place. They go into my potting shed, and over the winter I'll check those once every 2 weeks or once every month, depending on the quality of the potatoes when they get harvested and how dry they were going into the bags. Because what I want to find is any spud that's gone rotten before it ruins any of the spuds around it in the bag. And I can keep spuds that I take out of the ground now or later, or at the start of September, they'll stay in those paper bags for me, and they'll be used right the way up to the start of summer next year. And then, of course, I'll use some of them as the seed potatoes for next year to plant again in the garden. It's also time to be lifting some of the onions, shallots and garlic. A lot of those would have been taken out of the ground now, but some will be coming just ripe now. And again, you'll know when they're ready because the foliage will turn yellow and start to flop over. Again, once it's gone yellow, once all the chlorophyll has left it, you're not going to provide any more goodness to the fruit or to the vegetable under the ground. So it's time for it to come out. Easiest way to store the onions is in some netting, and hang the nets then somewhere cool and dark if you can. Or, of course, you can do the more traditional weaving of the onions and the garlic, and they hang quite well on that. I always use a piece of string, a piece of nylon string in the middle as I'm wrapping the onions and the garlic, and it means you're not relying on the stalk strength to hold up the whole bunch of onions, and so they don't come collapsing down during the winter. Time to continue. I'm cutting back the leaves on the grapevines in the greenhouse to allow the grapes to ripen, and I'm still removing some of the leaves on the cordons of tomatoes as well. So as a truss of tomatoes ripens from the bottom up on the plant, I'm pulling the leaves off to follow that up the plant. So very soon there'll only be the topmost leaves left on the plant. That's all the jobs for the garden this week. Enjoy what's in the garden and enjoy spending your time out there. And remember, you can keep in touch with us during the week on Twitter at NesbittF for me, or at Mags Morrissey for Mags, or you can email us at any stage, kitchengarden@crkc.ie. And you can listen to a podcast of this or any of the other shows by visiting thekitchengarden.ie. We'll be back on Community Radio Kilkenny City at the same time next week.